wasn't real life. College wasn't real life. It was a fantasy world, she knew, entirely different from the world she would face in just a few months. Her classes, unlike work, started at 10 in the morning and usually finished up around 2. Nights and weekends, meanwhile, were devoted almost entirely to fun and socializing and defying boundaries. It had absolutely nothing in common with the lives her parents led, at least as far as she could tell. As fun as college had been, she sometimes couldn't help feeling that her life had been on hold for the last few years. It wasn't until she'd met Luke that she realized how little she had really learned at school. Unlike her, Luke seemed like an adult. He hadn't gone to college, but he understood real life, people and relationships and work. He'd been one of the best in the world at something, bull riding, and she had no doubt he would be again. He could fix anything, and he'd built his own house. By any measure, he had mastered many things in life already, and right now, it struck her as inconceivable that she would be able to claim as much, even in entirely different areas, over the next 3 years. Who knew if she'd even be able to get a job in her chosen field, one that actually paid her? All she really knew was that she was here with Luke, and that spending time with him made her feel like she was finally, truly moving forward somehow. Because whatever they had between them was based in the real world, not the fantasy bubble of college life. Luke was as real as anyone she'd ever met. She heard the water shut off with a thump in the pipes, breaking the thread of her thoughts. Carrying her jelly jar of wine with her, she took a tour of the cabin. The kitchen was small and functional with inexpensive cabinets. Though the countertop was peeling and rusty rings stained the sink, it smelled of Lysol and bleach. The floors had been recently swept, and the surfaces were dust-free. The small living area sported scuffed pine flooring and cedar wall planking with just enough room for a frayed plaid couch and a pair of rocking chairs. Blue curtains framed the window, and a single lamp stood in the corner. Sophia crossed the room to turn it on, only to discover that it was no brighter than the single bulb in the kitchen had been, which no doubt explained the candles and matches on the coffee table. On a shelf opposite the windows lay a random assortment of books that she guessed had been left behind by other visitors, some hunting decoys, ducks, and a stuffed squirrel. A small television with rabbit ear antennas sat in the center of the shelf, and though she didn't bother to turn it on, she doubted it received more than one or two channels, if that. She heard the water come on again, and when the bathroom door squeaked open, Luke stepped out, looking clean and fresh in jeans and a white button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled up. He was barefoot, and he looked as though he'd raked his fingers through his wet hair rather than using a comb. From across the room, she could see a small white scar on his cheek, one she'd never noticed before.
"It's all yours," he said. "I've already got the water going for you."
"Thank you," she said. She kissed him briefly as she passed him. "I'll probably be 30 or 40 minutes.
"Take your time. I've got to get dinner going anyway."
"Another specialty?" she called from the bedroom where she scooped up her overnight bag.
"I like it."
"Does anyone else?"
"That's a good question. I guess we'll find out soon, huh?"
As promised, the water was already filling in the tub. It was hotter than she'd expected, and she turned the other faucet, trying to cool it a bit, wishing for some bubble bath or scented baby oil. She undressed, conscious of the soreness in her legs and lower back. She hoped she wouldn't be too stiff to walk tomorrow. Reaching for her wine, she slipped into the water, feeling luxurious despite her modest surroundings. The bathroom had a small, separate shower stall, and Luke had slung his used towel over the rod. The fact that he'd been naked in here only a few minutes earlier made something flutter in her lower belly. She'd known what might happen this weekend. For the first time, they wouldn't say goodbye near her car. Tonight, she wouldn't return to the sorority house. But being with Luke felt natural. It felt right, even if she admitted to herself she wasn't all that experienced in these kinds of things. Brian had been the first and only guy she'd ever slept with. It had happened at the Christmas formal, when they'd already been dating for 2 months. She hadn't known it would happen that night, but like everyone else, she was having fun and probably drinking too much, and when he brought her up to the room, they ended up making out on the bed. Brian was insistent. The room was spinning, and one thing led to the next. In the morning, she wasn't quite sure what to think about it. Nor was Brian there to help her. She vaguely remembered him talking to some friends the night before about having Bloody Marys in one of their rooms the next morning. She stumbled to the shower with a headache the size of Wisconsin, and as the spray ricocheted off her, a million thoughts raced through her head. She was relieved to have finally done it. Like everyone else, she'd wondered what it would be like, and was glad it had been with Brian, in a bed, as opposed to a back seat or something equally awkward. But for some reason, it also felt a little sad. She could imagine what her mom would think, or God forbid her dad. And frankly, she'd thought herself that it would be more... something. Meaningful. Romantic. Memorable. But really, what she wanted most of all just then was to head back to campus. After that, Brian was like most guys, she supposed. Whenever they were alone, he wanted something physical, and for a while, she supposed she did too. But then it began to feel as if it were all he ever wanted, and that began to bother her, even before he'd cheated on her. And now here she was, alone with a guy overnight for the first time since Brian. She wondered why she wasn't nervous, but she wasn't. Instead, she soaped up the washcloth and ran it over her skin, imagining what Luke was doing in the kitchen. She wondered if he was thinking about her as she soaked in the tub, maybe even picturing what she looked like without clothing. And again, she felt a flutter in her lower belly. She wanted this, she realized. She wanted to fall in love with someone she could trust. And she trusted Luke. Never once had he pressed her to do something she hadn't wanted. Never once had he been anything less than a perfect gentleman. The more time she'd spent with him, the more convinced she became that he was by far the sexiest guy she'd ever met. Who else did she know who could work with his hands the way he did? Who could make her laugh? Who was smart and charming, self-reliant and tender? And who else would take her horseback riding in one of the most beautiful places in the world? Soaking in the tub and sipping wine, she felt for the first time older than her years. She finished her wine, feeling warm and relaxed, and when the water began to cool, she climbed out of the tub and toweled off. She sorted through her bag, intending to throw on a pair of jeans, but then realized that it was all she ever wore when they were together. Changing her mind, she pulled out a skirt and a tight, form-fitting blouse and slipped them on. She styled her hair, feeling pleased that she'd remembered to bring both the curling iron and the dryer. Makeup came next. She added a touch more mascara and eyeshadow than she usually did, wiping the old mirror more than once to clear away the steam. She completed the outfit with a pair of gold hoop earrings that her mother had bought her for Christmas last year. When she was done, she looked herself over one more time. Then, with a deep breath, she picked up the empty jelly jar and stepped into the hallway. Luke stood in the kitchen, his back to her as he stirred a pot on the stove. On the counter next to him was a box of crackers and a beer, and she watched as he reached for the bottle, taking a long pull. He hadn't heard her leave the bathroom, and for a while she simply watched him in silence, admiring the fit of his jeans and his smooth, unhurried actions as he cooked. Quietly, she moved toward the end table and bent down to light the candles. She stood back to survey the scene, then stepped over to turn off the lamp. The room darkened, becoming more intimate, the small candle flames flickering. Luke, noticing the change in light, glanced over his shoulder.
"Oh, hey," he called out as she approached. "I didn't realize you were finished."
He trailed off as she emerged from the shadows into the soft yellow light of the kitchen. For a long moment, he drank in the sight of her, recognizing the hope and desire in the eyes that held his own.
"Sophia,"
he whispered, the sound so soft that she barely heard it. But in her name, she could hear everything he hadn't been able to say, and she knew in that moment that he was truly in love with her. And perhaps it was an illusion, but she also felt in that instant that he always would be, no matter what happened. With everything he had to give.
"I'm sorry for staring," Luke said. "You just look so beautiful."
She smiled as she continued to approach him, and when he leaned in to kiss her, she knew then that if she hadn't been in love with him before, she was surely in love with him now. After the kiss, she felt unsettled, and she sensed that Luke did as well. He turned around, lowering the flame beneath the burner, and reached for his beer, only to realize that he'd finished it. He set it beside the sink and went to the refrigerator to get another when he noticed the jelly jar she was holding.
"Would you like some more wine?" he asked.
She nodded, not trusting herself to speak, and handed him the glass. Their fingers brushed, sending a pleasant jolt through her hand. He pulled out the cork and poured some wine into the jelly jar.
"We could eat now if you'd like,"
he said, handing it back to her and recorking the bottle.
"But it'll taste better if we let it simmer for another half hour. I sliced up some of the cheese we bought earlier if you're hungry."
"Sounds good," she said. "Let's sit on the couch, though." He replaced the wine and pulled out a second beer for himself, then picked up the plate of cheese. He'd added grapes to the plate and reached for the box of crackers on the counter as he followed her to the couch. He put the food on the end table but held his beer as they took a seat next to each other. Luke opened one arm wide as she leaned into him, her back snug against his chest. She felt his arm go around her just below her breasts, and she rested her arm on top of his. She could feel the rise and fall of his chest, his steady breaths as the candles burned lower.
"It's so quiet up here,"
she remarked as he shifted his beer to the end table and wrapped his other arm around her as well.
"I can't hear anything outside at all."
"You'll probably hear the horses later," he said.
"They're not the quietest animals, and they're right outside the bedroom. And sometimes raccoons get onto the porch, and they'll knock all sorts of stuff over."
"Why did you stop coming here?" she asked. "Was it because of your dad?"
When Luke spoke, his voice was subdued.
"After my dad died, a lot of things changed. My mom was alone, and I was traveling on the circuit. When I was home, it always felt like we were so far behind, but I guess that's really an excuse. For my mom, this was their place. I'd spend so much time outside riding and swimming and playing that I'd just collapse in bed right after dinner. My mom and dad would have the place to themselves. Later, when I was in high school, they used to sometimes come up here without me. But now, she doesn't want to come. I've asked, but she just shakes her head. I think she wants to remember this place like it used to be, when he was still with us."
She took another sip of wine.
"I was thinking earlier about how much you've been through. In some ways, it's like you've lived a full life already."
"I hope not," he said. "I'd hate for you to think I'm over the hill."
She smiled, conscious of the contact between her body and his, trying not to think about what might come later.
"Do you remember the first night we met? When we talked and you took me out to show me the bulls?"
"Of course."
"Could you ever have imagined that we'd end up here?"
He reached out for his beer and took a sip before resting it on the couch beside her. She could feel the chill from the bottle near her thigh.
"At the time, I was just surprised you were talking to me at all."
"Why would you be surprised?"
He kissed her hair.
"Do you really have to ask? You're perfect."
"I'm not perfect," she protested. "I'm far from it."
She swirled the wine in her jar.
"Just ask Brian."
"What happened with him had nothing to do with you."
"Maybe not," she said. "But..."
Luke said nothing, allowing her time to consider what she was going to say. She turned, looking directly at him.
"I told you that last spring I was a wreck, right? And that I lost a lot of weight because I couldn't eat?"
"You told me."
"All that's true. But I didn't tell you that for a while there, I also thought about suicide. It wasn't like I came close to actually doing anything about it. It was more like a concept, something that I latched onto to feel better. I'd wake up and not care about anything and not be able to eat. And then I'd think that there was one sure way to stop the pain, and that was to end it all. Even then I knew it was crazy, and like I said, I never really thought I'd go through with it. But just knowing that the option was there made me feel like I still had some kind of control. And at the time, that's what I needed more than anything. To think that I was in control. And little by little, I was able to pull myself together. That's why the next time Brian cheated on me, I was able to walk away. She closed her eyes, the memory of those days passing like a shadow over her face. "You're probably thinking you've made a big mistake right about now."
"Not at all,"
he said. "Even if I'm crazy?"
"You're not crazy. You said yourself you never really considered going through with it."
"But why would I latch on to the idea? Why would I even think about it at all?"
"Do you still think about it?"
"Never," she said. "Not since last spring.
Then I wouldn't worry too much. You're not the first person in the world to think about it. It's a big leap from thinking to considering, and an even bigger leap to attempting.
She weighed the comment, recognizing his point. You're being too logical about the whole thing.
That's probably because I have no idea what I'm talking about.
She squeezed his arm. No one knows any of this, by the way. Not my mom or dad or even Marcia.
I won't tell, he said. But if it happens again, you might consider talking to someone a whole lot smarter than I am. Someone who would know what to tell you, maybe help you navigate the whole thing.
I plan on it.
But hopefully it won't happen again.
They sat in silence, his body warm against hers.
I still think you're perfect,
he offered, making her laugh. You're a sweet talker, she teased. She tilted her head up, kissing him on the cheek. But can I ask you something?
Anything, he answered.
You said that your mom wanted to double the size of the herd, and when I asked why, you said she didn't have a choice. What does that mean? He traced a finger along the back of her hand.
It's a long story.
That again? Then answer me this. Does it have anything to do with Big Ugly Critter? She felt his muscles tighten involuntarily, if only for an instant.
Why would you say that?
Call it a hunch, she said. You never finished that story either, so I just assumed they might be related. She hesitated. I'm right, aren't I? She felt him take a long breath and then release it slowly.
I thought I knew his tendencies, Luke began. And I did at first. Halfway through the ride, I made a mistake. I leaned too far forward just as Big Ugly Critter threw his head back, and I was knocked unconscious. When I toppled off, Big Ugly Critter ended up dragging me around the arena. He dislocated my shoulder, but that wasn't the worst of it.
Luke scratched the stubble on his cheek, then continued, his voice matter-of-fact, almost distant.
As I lay there in the dirt, the bull came back at me. It was pretty bad. I ended up in the ICU for a while, but the doctors did amazing work and I got lucky. After I woke up, I recovered a lot faster than they thought I would. But I still had to stay in the hospital for a long time, and then there were months of rehab. And my mom...
He trailed off, and though he was telling the story without emotion, Sophia could feel her own heart beginning to speed up as she tried to picture his injuries.
My mom... She did what most moms would do, right? She did whatever she could to make sure I got the best care possible. But the thing is, I didn't have health insurance. Bull riders can't really get it because of how dangerous riding is. Or at least they couldn't back then. The tour provides minimal coverage, but it was nowhere near enough to cover the cost of my hospital care. So my mom had to mortgage the ranch.
He paused, suddenly looking older than his years.
The terms weren't great, and the rates are going to readjust next summer. And the ranch doesn't have enough income to cover those upcoming loan payments. We can barely meet them now. We've been doing everything we can this past year to figure out how to squeeze some more money out of the place, but it's just not working. We're not even close.
What does that mean?
It means we're going to have to sell it. Or, in the end, the bank is going to take it. And this is the only life my mom knows. She built the business, and she's lived on the ranch her entire life.
He let out a long exhale before going on.
She's 55 years old. Where would she go? What would she do? Me? I'm young. I can go anywhere. But for her to lose everything? Because of me? I just can't do that to her. I won't.
Which is why you started riding again, Sophia said.
Yeah,
he admitted.
It'll help cover the payments, and with a few good years, I can make a dent in what we owe so that we can get the principal down to something manageable.
Sophia brought her knees up. Then why doesn't she want you to ride? Luke seemed to choose his words carefully.
She doesn't want me to get hurt again. But what other choice do I have? I don't even want to ride anymore. It's not the same for me. But I don't know what else to do. As best I can figure, we can last until June, maybe July. And then...
The guilt and anguish in his expression made her chest constrict. Maybe you'll find that other pasture you need.
Maybe, he said, sounding less than sure. Anyway, that's what's going on with the ranch. It's not all that pretty. That's one of the reasons I wanted to bring you here. Because being here with you meant that I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to worry. All I've done since I've been here is think about you and how glad I am that you're with me.
Just as he'd predicted, one of the horses outside let out a long neigh. The room was growing cooler, a cold mountain air seeping through the windows and the walls.
I should probably check our dinner, he said. Make sure it's not burning.
With reluctance, Sophia sat up, letting Luke squeeze past. The guilt he felt at his role in jeopardizing the ranch was so genuine, so evident, that she found herself rising from the couch to follow. She needed him to know that she was here to comfort him, not because he needed her to, but because she wanted to. The love she felt for him altered everything, and she wanted him to feel that. He was stirring the chili when she came up behind him and slipped her arms around his waist. He stood straighter, and she squeezed him lightly before loosening her grip. He turned around and pulled her close. Their bodies came together then, and she leaned into him. For a long time, they simply held each other. He felt so good to her. She could feel his heart beating in his chest, could hear the gentle rhythm of his breaths. She tucked her face into his neck, inhaling his scent, and as she did, she felt desire flooding her body in a way she had never experienced before. She slowly kissed his neck, listening to his rapid breath.
I love you, Sophia, he whispered.
I love you too, Luke, she whispered back as his face inched closer to hers. Her only thought as they began to kiss was that this was the way it should always be, forever. Hesitant at first, their kisses became more passionate, and when she raised her eyes, she knew her desire was plain. She wanted all of him, more than she had ever wanted anyone, and after kissing him one more time, she reached behind him, turning off the burner. Without breaking his gaze, she reached for his hand and slowly began leading him to the bedroom.
Ira. Evening again, and still I am here, cocooned in silence, entered by the white hard cold of winter, and unable to move. I've lasted more than a day now. At my age and considering my plight, this should be cause for celebration, but I'm weakening now. Only my pain and thirst seem real. My body is failing, and it is everything I can do to keep my eyes open. They will close again in time, and part of me wonders whether they will ever open again. I stare at Ruth, wondering why she says nothing. She does not look at me. Instead, I see her in profile. With every blink, she seems to be changing. She is young and old and young again. And I wonder what she is thinking with each transformation. As much as I love her, I admit that she has always remained somewhat of an enigma to me. In the mornings, as we sat at the breakfast table, I would catch her staring out the window. In those moments, she looked the same as she does right now, and my eyes would often follow hers. We would sit in silence, watching the birds as they flitted from one branch to the next, or gaze at the clouds as they slowly gathered shape. Sometimes I would study her, trying to intuit her thoughts, but she would offer only a slight smile, perfectly content to keep me in the dark. I liked this about her. I liked the mystery she added to my life. I liked the occasional silence between us, for ours was a comfortable silence. It was a passionate silence, one that had its roots in comfort and desire. I have often wondered whether this made us unique, or whether it was something that couples often experience. It would sadden me to think that we were an exception, but I've lived long enough to conclude that what Ruth and I had was an uncommon blessing. And still, Ruth says nothing. Perhaps she, too, is reliving the days that we once shared. After Ruth and I returned from our honeymoon, we began the process of creating a life together. By then, her parents had already moved to Durham, and Ruth and I stayed with my parents while we looked for a home to buy. Though a number of new neighborhoods were springing up in Greensboro, Ruth and I wanted a home with character. We spent most of our time walking through homes in the historic district, and it was there that we found a Queen Anne that had been built in 1886, with a front facing gable, a round tower and porches gracing the front and back. My first thought that it was far too large for us, with more space than we would ever need. It was also desperately in need of renovation. But Ruth loved the moldings and the craftsmanship, and I loved her. So when she said she'd leave the decision up to me, I made an offer the following afternoon. While the paperwork with the bank loan was being finalized, we would move in a month later. I went back to work at the shop while Ruth threw herself into her teaching job. I admit that I was nervous for her. The rural school where she'd been hired largely served students who'd grown up on farms. More than half of them lived in homes without indoor plumbing, and many wore the same clothes day after day. Two arrived in class on the first day without shoes. Only a handful seemed to care about learning, and more than a few were fundamentally illiterate. It was the kind of poverty she'd never before experienced, less about money than a poverty of dreams. In those first few months of teaching, I'd never seen Ruth more frazzled, nor would I ever see her that way again. It takes a teacher both time and experience to formalize lesson plans and to become comfortable in even the best schools. And I often saw Ruth working late into the evenings at our small kitchen table, thinking of new ways to engage her students. But as harried as she was during that first semester, it became plain that teaching such students, even more than the artwork we eventually collected, was not only her calling, but her true passion. She took to the job with a single-minded intensity that surprised me. She wanted her students to learn, but more than that, she wanted them to treasure education in the same way she did. The challenge she faced with such disadvantaged students only fired her enthusiasm. Over dinner, she would talk to me about her students and would recount to me the little victories that could make her smile for days. And that is how she would describe them. "Ira," she would tell me, "one of my students had a little victory in class today," before she proceeded to tell me exactly what had happened. She would tell me when a child unexpectedly shared a pencil with another, or how much their penmanship had improved, or the pride that a student demonstrated at reading her first book. Beyond that, she cared for them. She would notice when one of them was upset and would speak to them as a mother would. When she learned that a number of her students were too poor to bring lunch to school, she began to make extra sandwiches in the morning. And slowly but surely, her students responded to her nurturing ways, like young plants to sun and water. She had been worried about whether the children would accept her, because she was Jewish in a school that was almost exclusively Christian, because she was from Vienna and had a German accent. She wasn't sure whether they would regard her as alien. She had never said this directly to me, but I knew it for certain one day in December when I found her sobbing in the kitchen at the end of the day. Her eyes were swollen and raw, frightening me. I imagined that something terrible had happened to her parents, or perhaps that she'd been in an accident of some sort. Then I noticed that the table was littered with an assortment of homemade items. She explained that her students, each and every one, had brought her gifts in celebration of Hanukkah. She would never be sure how it had come about. She hadn't told them about the holiday, nor was it clear that any of the students understood the meaning of the celebration. Later she would tell me that she heard one of the students explaining to another that Hanukkah is the way Jews celebrate the birth of Jesus. But the truth was less important than the meaning of what the children had done for her. Most of the gifts were simple: painted rocks, handmade cards, a bracelet made of seashells. But in every gift there was love, and it was in that moment I later came to believe that Ruth finally accepted Greensboro, North Carolina, as her home. Despite Ruth's workload, we were slowly able to furnish our home. We spent many weekends during that first year shopping for antiques. In the same way she had an eye for art, she had a gift for selecting the kind of furniture that would make our home not only uniquely beautiful but welcoming. The following summer, we would begin renovations. The house needed a new roof, and the kitchen and bathrooms, though functional, were not to Ruth's liking. The floors needed to be sanded, and many windows had to be replaced. We had decided when purchasing the house to wait until the following summer to begin the repairs, when Ruth would have time to supervise the workers. I was relieved that she was willing to assume this responsibility. My mother and father had cut back further on the time they spent at work, but the shop had only grown busier in the year that Ruth had begun teaching. As my father had done during the war, I again took over the lease on the space next to ours. I expanded the store and hired 3 additional employees. Even then, I struggled to keep up. Like Ruth, I often worked late into the evenings. The renovations on the house took longer and cost more than expected, and it went without saying that it was far more inconvenient than either of us imagined the process might be. It was the end of July, 1947, before the final worker carried his toolbox to the truck. But the changes, some subtle, others dramatic, made the house finally seem really ours. And I have lived there for over 65 years now. Unlike me, the house is still holding up reasonably well. Water flows smoothly through the pipes. The cabinets swing open with ease, and the floors are as flat as a billiard table. Whereas I can no longer move from room to room without the use of my walker. If I have one complaint, it's that the house seems drafty. But then I've been cold for so long that I've forgotten what it's like to feel warm. To me, the house is still filled with love, and at this point in my life, I could ask for nothing more. "It is filled, all right," Ruth snorts. "The house, I mean." I detect a note of disapproval in her tone and glance at her. "I like it the way it is."
"It is dangerous."
"It's not dangerous."
"No. What if there is a fire? How would you get out?"
"If there was a fire, I'd have trouble getting out, even if the house stood empty."
"You are making excuses."
"I'm old. I might be senile."
"You are not senile. You are stubborn."
"I like to remember. There's a difference."
"This is not good for you. The memories sometimes make you sad."
"Maybe," I say, looking directly at her. "But memories are all that I have left." Ruth is right about the memories, of course. But she is also right about the house. It's filled, not with junk, but with the artwork we collected. For years, we kept the paintings in climate-controlled storage units that I rented by the month. Ruth preferred it that way. She always worried about fires. But after she died, I hired 2 workers to bring everything back home. Now every wall is a kaleidoscope of paintings, and paintings fill 4 of the 5 bedrooms. Neither the sitting room nor the dining room has been usable for years, because paintings are stacked in every spare inch. While hundreds of pieces were framed, most of them were not. Instead, those are separated by acid-free paper,
and stored in a number of flat oak boxes, labeled by the year that I had them built by a carpenter here in town. I'll admit that there's a cluttered extravagance to the house that some might find claustrophobic. The journalist who came to the house wandered from room to room with her mouth agape. But my home is clean. The cleaning service sends a woman to my house twice a week to keep the rooms I still use spotless. And though few, if any, of these women over the years spoke English, I know that Ruth would have been pleased I hired them. Ruth always hated dust or mess of any sort. The clutter does not bother me. Instead, it reminds me of some of the best days of my marriage, including, and especially, our trips to Black Mountain College. After the renovations were completed, when both of us were in need of a vacation, we spent our first anniversary at the Grove Park Inn, the place we'd honeymooned. Again, we visited the college, but this time we were greeted by friends. Elaine and Willem weren't there, but Robert and Ken were, and they introduced us to Susan Weil and Pat Pasloff, two extraordinary artists whose work also hangs in numerous museums. That year, we came home with 14 more paintings. Even then, however, neither of us was thinking of becoming collectors. We were not rich, after all, and the purchase of those paintings had been a stretch, especially after the renovations on the house. Nor did we hang all of them right away. Instead, Ruth would rotate them from room to room, depending on her moods, and more than once I came home to a house that felt both the same and different. In 1948 and 1949, we found ourselves returning yet again to Asheville and Black Mountain College. We purchased even more paintings, and when we returned home, Ruth's father suggested that we take our hobby more seriously. Like Ruth, he could see the quality in the work we'd purchased. And he planted in us the seed of an idea, to build a true collection, one that might one day be worthy of a museum. I could tell that Ruth was intrigued by the idea. Though we made no official decision one way or the other, we began saving nearly all of Ruth's salary, and she spent much of the year writing letters to the artists we knew, asking their opinions about other artists they believed we might like. In 1950, after a trip to the Outer Banks, we traveled to New York for the first time. We spent 3 weeks visiting every gallery in the city, meeting owners and artists whom our friends had introduced us to. That summer, we laid the groundwork for a network that would continue to grow for the next 4 decades. At the end of that summer, we returned to the place where it had all begun, almost as though we had no other choice. I'm not sure when we first began to hear the rumors that Black Mountain College might close, 1952 or 1953, I think. But like the artists and the faculty we had come to think of as close friends, we wanted to dismiss them. In 1956, however, our fears came true. And when Ruth heard the news, she wept, recognizing the end of an era for us. That summer, we again traveled throughout the Northeast, and though I knew it wouldn't be the same, we concluded our travels by returning to Asheville for our anniversary. As always, we drove to the college, but as we stood by the waters of Lake Eden and stared at the now vacant buildings of the college, I couldn't help wondering whether our idyll at the college had been nothing more than a dream. In time, we made our way to the spot where those first 6 paintings had once been displayed. We stood beside the silent blue water, and I thought of how appropriate the name of the lake had been. To us, after all, this spot had always been like Eden itself. I knew that no matter where our lives took us, we would never leave this place behind. Surprising Ruth, I offered her a letter I'd written the night before. It was the first letter I'd written to Ruth since I'd been in the war. and after reading it, Ruth took me in her arms. In that moment, I knew what I had to do to keep this place alive in our hearts. The following year, on our 11th anniversary, I wrote another letter to her, which she read under those very same trees on the shores of Lake Eden. And with that, a new tradition in our marriage began. In all, Ruth received 45 letters, and she saved every one. They are stored in a box that she kept atop her chest of drawers. Sometimes I would catch her reading them, and I could tell by her smile that she was reliving something she'd long since forgotten. These letters had become something of a diary to her, and as she grew older, she began to pull them out more frequently, sometimes reading them all in the course of a single afternoon. The letters seemed to give her peace, and I think this is why, much later, she decided to write to me. I did not find this letter until after she was gone, but in many ways it saved my life. She knew I would need it, for she knew me better than I ever knew myself. But Ruth has not read all the letters I've written to her. She couldn't. Though I wrote them for her, I also wrote them for me, after all. And after she passed away, I placed another box beside the original. In this box are letters written with a shaking hand, letters marked only by my tears, not hers. They are letters written on what would have been yet another anniversary. Sometimes I think about reading them just as she used to, but it hurts me to think that she never had the chance. Instead, I simply hold them, and when the ache becomes too great, I'll wander the house and stare at the paintings. And sometimes when I do, I like to imagine that Ruth has come to visit me, just as she has come to me in the car, because she knows, even now, that I can't live without her. "You can live without me," Ruth says to me. Outside the car, the winds have died down and the darkness seems less opaque. This is moonlight, I think to myself, and I realize that the weather is finally clearing. By tomorrow night, if I last that long, the weather will begin to improve, and by Tuesday the snow will be melting. For a moment this gives me hope, but as quickly as it comes, the feeling fades away. I will not last that long. I am weak, so weak that even focusing on Ruth is difficult. The inside of the car is moving in circles, and I want to reach for her hand to steady me, but I know that's impossible. Instead, I try to remember the feel of her touch, but the sensation eludes me. "Are you listening to me?" she asks. I close my eyes, trying to make the dizziness stop, but it only increases, colored spirals exploding behind my eyes. "Yes," I finally whisper, a dry rasp in the volcanic ash of my throat. My thirst claws at me with a vengeance, worse than before, infinitely worse. It's been more than a day since I've had anything to drink, and the desire for water consumes me, growing stronger with every labored breath. "The water bottle is here," Ruth suddenly says to me. "I think it is on the floor by my feet." Her voice is soft and lilting, like a melody, and I try to latch on to the sound to avoid thinking about the obvious.
"How do you know?"
"I do not know for sure, but where else can it be? It is not on the seat." She's right, I think to myself. It's likely on the floor, but there is nothing I can do to reach it.
"It doesn't matter," I finally say in despair.
"Of course it matters. You must find a way to reach the bottle."
"I can't,"
I say.
"I'm not strong enough."
She seems to absorb this and remains quiet for a moment. In the car, I think I hear her breathing before I realize that it is I who has begun to wheeze. The blockage in my throat has begun to form again.
"Do you,"
remember the tornado? She suddenly asks me. There is something in her voice imploring me to concentrate, and I try to figure out what she's referring to. The tornado. It means nothing at first. And then, slowly, the memory begins to acquire shape and significance. I'd been home from work for an hour when all at once the sky turned an ominous shade of grayish green. Ruth stepped outside to investigate, and I remember seizing her by the hand to drag her to the bathroom in the center of the house. It was the first tornado she'd ever experienced, and though our house was unharmed, a tree down the street had been toppled, crushing a neighbor's car.
It was 1957,
I say.
April.
Yes, she says. That is when it happened. I am not surprised you remembered. You always remember the weather, even from long ago.
I remember because I was frightened.
But you remember the weather now, too.
I watch the Weather Channel.
This is good. There are many good programs on this channel. There is sometimes much to learn.
Why are we talking about this?
Because, she says to me, urgency in her tone, there is something you must remember. There is something more. I don't understand what she means, and in my exhaustion I realize I suddenly don't care. The wheeze grows worse, and I close my eyes, beginning to float on a sea of dark, undulating waves, toward a distant horizon, away from here, away from her. You have seen something interesting lately, she shouts. And still I drift, outside the car, flying now, under the moon and stars. The night is clearing and the wind has died, and I'm so tired I know I will sleep forever. I feel my limbs relax and lose heft.
Ira!
She shouts, the panic in her voice rising. There is something you must remember. It was on the Weather Channel. Her voice sounds far away, almost like an echo.
A man in Sweden, she shouts. He had no food or water.
Though I can barely hear her, the words somehow register. Yes, I think. And the memory, like the tornado, also begins to take shape. Umea, Arctic Circle, 64 days. He survived, she shouts. She reaches for me, her hand coming to rest on my leg. And in that moment I stop drifting. When I open my eyes, I'm back in the car. Buried in his car, in the snow. No food or water. No water. No water. Ruth leans toward me. So close I can smell the delicate rose notes of her perfume. Yes, Ira, she says, her expression serious. He had no water. So how did he survive? You must remember. I blink, and my eyes feel scaly, like those of a reptile. Snow, I say. He ate the snow. She holds my gaze, and I know she is daring me to look away. There is snow here, too, she says. There is snow right outside your window. At her words, I feel something surge inside me despite my weakness. And though I am afraid of movement, I nonetheless raise my left arm slowly. I inch it forward on my thigh and then lift it, moving it to the armrest. The exertion feels mammoth, and I take a moment to catch my breath. But Ruth is right. There is water close by, and I stretch my finger toward the button. I'm afraid the window won't open, but I still stretch my finger forward. Something primal keeps me going. I hope the battery still works. It worked before, I tell myself again.
It worked after the accident. Finally, my finger meets the button, and I push it forward. And like a miracle, bitter cold suddenly invades the interior. The chill is brutal, and a dab of snow lands on the back of my hand. So close now, but I'm facing the wrong way. I must lift my head. The task seems insurmountable, but the water calls out to me, and it is impossible not to answer. I raise my head, and my arm and shoulder and collarbone explode. I see nothing but white, and then nothing but black, but I keep on going. My face feels swollen, and for an instant I don't think I'll make it. I want to put my head back down. I want the pain to end. Yet my left hand is already moving toward me. The snow is already melting, and I can feel the water dripping, and my hand keeps moving. And then, just when I'm on the brink of giving up, my hand meets my mouth. The snow is wonderful, and my mouth seems to come alive. I can feel the wetness on my tongue. It is cold and sharp and heavenly, and I feel the individual drops of water trace a path down my throat. The miracle emboldens me, and I reach for another handful of snow. I swallow some more, and the needles vanish. My throat is suddenly young like Ruth, and though the car is freezing, I do not even feel the cold. I take another handful of snow and then another, and the exhaustion I felt just a minute ago is dissipated. I'm tired and weak, but this seems infinitely bearable by comparison. When I look at Ruth, I can see her clearly. She's in her 30s, that age when she was most beautiful of all, and she is glowing. "Thank you," I finally say. "There is no reason to thank me," she shrugs. "But you should roll up the window now, before you get too cold." I do as she tells me, my eyes never leaving hers.
"I love you, Ruth," I croak.
"I know," she says, her expression tender. "That is why I have come." The water has restored me in a way that seemed impossible even a few hours earlier. By this I mean my mind. My body is still a wreck and I am still afraid to move, but Ruth seems comforted by my recovery. She sits quietly, listening to the chatter of my thoughts. Mostly I am preoccupied with the question of whether someone will ever find me. In this world, after all, I've become more or less invisible, even when I filled my tank with gasoline, which led to me getting lost, I now think. The woman behind the counter looked past me toward a young man in jeans. I've become what the young are afraid of becoming, just another member of the nameless elderly, an old and broken man with nothing left to offer to this world. My days are inconsequential, comprising simple moments and even simpler pleasures. I eat and sleep and think of Ruth. I wander the house and stare at the paintings. And in the mornings I feed the pigeons that gather in my backyard. My neighbor complains about this. He thinks the birds are a disease-ridden nuisance. He may have a point. But he also cut down a magnificent maple tree that straddled our properties simply because he was tired of raking the leaves, so his judgment isn't something that I consider altogether trustworthy. Anyway, I like the birds. I like the gentle cooing noises they make, and I enjoy watching their heads bob up and down as they pursue the seed I scatter for them. I know that most people consider me to be a recluse. That's how the journalist described me. As much as I despise the word and what it implies, there is some truth to what she wrote about me. I've been a widower for years, a man without children, and as far as I know, I have no living relatives. My friends, aside from my attorney, Howie Sanders, have long since passed away. And since the media storm, the one unleashed by the article in The New Yorker, I seldom leave the house,
It's easier that way. But I frequently wonder whether I should have ever talked to the journalist in the first place. Probably not. But when Janice or Janet or whatever her name was showed up at the door unannounced, her dark hair and intelligent eyes reminded me of Ruth. And the next thing I knew, she was standing in the living room. She didn't leave for the next 6 hours. How she found out about the collection, I still don't know. Probably from an art dealer up north. They can be bigger gossips than schoolgirls. But even so, I didn't blame her for all that followed. She was doing her job and I could have asked her to leave, but instead, I answered her questions and allowed her to take photographs. After she left, I promptly put her out of my mind. Then a few months later, a squeaky-voiced young man who described himself as a fact-checker for the magazine phoned to verify things that I had said. Naively, I gave him the answers he wanted, only to receive a small package in the mail several weeks later. The journalist had been thoughtful enough to send me a copy of the issue in which the article appeared. Needless to say, the article enraged me. I threw it away after reading what she'd written. But later, after I'd cooled down, I retrieved it from the trash and read it once more. In retrospect, I realized it wasn't her fault that she hadn't understood what I'd been trying to tell her. In her mind, after all, the collection was the entirety of the story. That was 6 years ago, and it turned my life upside down. Bars went up on the windows and a fence was installed that circled the yard. I had a security system put in and the police began making a point to drive past my house at least twice a day. I was deluged with phone calls, reporters, producers, a screenwriter who promised to put the story on the big screen, 3 or 4 lawyers, 2 people who claimed to be related, distant cousins on Ruth's side of the family. Strangers down on their luck and looking for handouts. In the end, I simply unplugged the phone. For all of them, including the journalist, thought about the art only in terms of money. What every last person failed to see was that it was not about money, it was about the memories they held. If Ruth had the letters I wrote her, I had the paintings and the memories. When I see the de Koonings and the Rauschenbergs and the Warhols, I recall the way Ruth held me as we stood by the lake. When I see the Jackson Pollock, I am reliving that first trip to New York in 1950. We were halfway through our trip, and on a whim we drove out to Springs, a hamlet near East Hampton on Long Island. It was a glorious summer day, and Ruth wore a yellow dress. She was 28 then, and growing more beautiful with every passing day, something that Pollock did not fail to notice. I am convinced that it was her elegant bearing that moved him to allow 2 strangers into his studio. It also explains why he eventually allowed Ruth to purchase a painting he'd only recently completed, something he seldom, if ever, did again. Later that afternoon, on our way back to the city, Ruth and I stopped at a small cafe in Watermill. It was a charming place with scuffed wood floors and sun-drenched windows, and the owner led us to a wobbly outdoor table. On that day, Ruth ordered white wine, something light and sweet, and we sipped from our glasses while gazing out over the Sound. The breeze was light and the day was warm, and when we spotted the occasional boat passing in the distance, we'd wonder aloud where it might be headed. Hanging next to that painting is a work by Jasper Johns. We bought it in 1952, the summer that Ruth's hair was at its longest. The first faint lines were beginning to form at the corners of her eyes, adding a womanly quality to her face. She and I had stood atop the Empire State Building earlier that morning. And later, in the quiet of our hotel room, Ruth and I made love for hours before she finally fell asleep in my arms. I could not sleep that day. Instead, I stared at her, watching the gentle rise and fall of her chest, her skin warm against my own. In the dim surroundings of that room, her hair splayed over the pillow, I found myself asking whether any man had ever been as lucky as I. This is why I wonder.